I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World. Through the eyes this hour of novelists who see Americans as the other. I love the idea that artists and writers get there first. The best of them see the future and they tell the truth. They're the antennae of the species. They live in their imaginations what you and I will face in life. Maybe you have your own favorite prophetic writers. Mine include Dostoevsky, who foresaw the criminality of the Soviet century in Russia. Graham Greene, whose quiet American envisioned the Vietnam quagmire a decade before the U.S. got stuck in it. And Joseph Conrad, whose secret agent envisioned something very like 9/11 almost a century before it happened. Add three more writers that we'll meet this hour, authors in a sense of the global consciousness. Amin Maalouf moved to Paris from Lebanon 25 years ago. He's a best-selling novelist and essayist in Europe, a global spirit, and a border jumper.
I'd love to see a debate in which an Arab and a Jew debate, but the Arab is defending the opinion of the Jews and the Jew is defending the opinion of the Arabs. And I feel I belong to this kind of debate.
Amitabh Ghosh from Calcutta, now living in New York, has made a specialty of the tragic marks that empire has etched in all of our minds.
I'm Indian. I live in America. The conflict that we see today almost seems to be bringing my life full circle.
Azhar Nafisi, an Iranian scholar at Johns Hopkins, knows exactly why we feed on imaginative literature in times like this.
Great works of fiction become automatically subversive, not because they take political positions, but because they basically question reality as it is.
The Whole Wide World is the radio program that keeps looking under the hood of globalization, this sudden shrinking of the worlds of trade, culture, disease, medicine, and instant internet communications about all our hopes and fears for the planet. The spirit this hour comes from the Robert Burns line, "Oh, would some power the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us." So we're taking a double jump into the minds of writers first, but writers from afar. On the Paris Metro, going to meet Amin Maalouf, I felt like a pilgrim to Canterbury, or Mecca, or the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, or all three, because Amin Maalouf knows all three religions of the book. He knows all the borrowings and buffeting among them, of course, and the tensions. But in his head, it's not so much a culture clash as a culture bath in the shared rituals and also the food and music of the old Mediterranean. We talked for 2 days in his Paris apartment near the Arc de Triomphe. Maalouf's most famous creation is Leo the African. He's a happy wanderer from Andalusia in 15th century Spain to Morocco, to Egypt, to Rome. He's a cultural sponge and a complete global citizen in his time, as Amin Maalouf is in ours. Leo's life in the 15th and 16th centuries turns out to be a dream version of Maalouf's own.
It's some kind of symbolic autobiography in the form of a biography. I was born in Lebanon in a very small community, and I was always, from my childhood, always asking myself to what do I belong, to what country, to what part of the world, to what religion, to what culture.
He decided as a boy to embrace the whole multiplicity of perspectives as a gift from heaven. And then he bestowed the same gift on Leo the African at a multicultural moment and location in southern Spain.
It was the area where the three religions met at one point of history. Christians, Muslims, and Jews built something together. Of course, there were tensions. Of course, it was never the paradise on earth. But still, they built a worthy civilization together, each one with its own cultural flavor. And for me, it's a mythical time. Sometimes many events come at the same moment, and the year 1492 is one of those years. Because it's the year of the discovery of America. It's also the year when the Arabs and Jews were expelled together, and I love that idea. And at the same time, it was the year, because of those expulsions, the time when the intermingling between those cultures stopped.
There is the start of what became Amin Maalouf's life project, that is, to intermingle cultures anew, to reopen spaces where individuals could shed their labels and cross lines as they like. On the internet, I said to him, everybody can be Leo the African, but of course it's not that simple on the ground.
Living together is something very difficult. I come from Lebanon, which means that I come from a society where there are people from different backgrounds, but in a society which has known very violent conflicts. I had to leave my country because of one of those conflicts, very, very bloody conflict. And I cannot see the coexistence as something easy. For me, coexistence is something one has to fight for. It's something we have to think about it every moment.
The disarming of identities has, in fact, become a sort of vocation.
I try to speak to every person that takes a book into his hand and tell that person, you're different. Just discover in what way you're different. And that's why your life is worthwhile. I think this is the message of Leo the African. And this is, frankly, the main message of my life, of my work, to try to dissolve groups, dissolve the monstrous groups that give the impression that the world is made of blocks, and we have to dissolve blocks into human beings, individual human beings, each one different from the other, each one having his and her own life, only one life, a beautiful thing, but only one life, to live fully, freely, and to make a masterpiece out of it.
Amin Maalouf's slim nonfiction book called In the Name of Identity became required reading in Europe at the end of the Balkan Wars. Religious and ethnic identity, he said, had become in practice a weapon, a reason to hate or to kill someone. He had observed identity in the Lebanese Civil War of the 1970s as a wild beast, a panther, as he called it.
What I call a panther is something very specific. During the few months in which I lived in Lebanon during that war, I understood that any person put in specific conditions could become a monster. And I felt that probably if the war had begun when I was 16 instead of 26, I would probably have been with other young people on some barricade, and at one point maybe we would have been engaged in fighting and would have killed people. And I felt very strongly that the killer in each one of us, that panther, it's there. Identity in the accepted sense of today, and in my view, the accepted sense is the sense that promotes killers. The accepted sense is that identity can be summed up with one element of identity. Whenever one feels that he's just this or that, just Christian, just Muslim, just Serb, just Croat, whenever it is summed up in just one word, that means automatically that it is defined by opposition to somebody else. usually a neighbor. So it becomes a definition for war.
How have you worked it out for yourself? When people ask you, and you've lived your life roughly half in France and half in Lebanon, are you Lebanese? Are you French? How do you deal with it?
I say I am Lebanese and I am French. And I am Mediterranean, and I am Arab, and I'm European, and I am a few other things, and I would like to be more things again. And but it's not easy, you know. Even that, my struggle as a writer is to make people feel that their identity is many things. And that what is important is not just to limit oneself to this or that element of identity, but to let their identity explode like fireworks.
The trick for each of us is to get comfortable with compound identities on the way to feeling human.
It's becoming a matter of survival. For me, in this age of globalization, of accelerated globalization, we can no more afford to assert aggressive identities. Either we go beyond those identities and we build common society, common world society, or we risk disappearing in a sea of blood.
There's a wonderful close in your book about identity. It brought tears to my eyes the first time I read it. You said most authors finish a book hoping that it'll be read forever. Your hope was that your grandson, perhaps growing up and finding it one day by chance on the family bookshelves, would look through the pages, read a passage or two, then put it back in a dusty corner where he found it, shrugging his shoulders and marveling that in his grandfather's day such things still needed to be said.
I'm not sure that the world in which my sons and my grandsons will be living would be a friendlier world than the one I lived in. It can go both ways. When I look at what happened in the 20th century, all the dangers that we went through, Nazism, Stalinism, atomic bomb, all what seems to be on the verge of destroying mankind. And almost miraculously, we escaped. Against all odds, we escaped. That's also what makes me a bit puzzled and sad, that when the century ended, my feeling was that we were going in the right direction. We have overcome so many dangers, and now we are going to be able to settle the last remaining regional problems and then concentrate on what is, in my view, the most important, which is the human adventure in biology, in culture, and which is the only real thrilling future that I can imagine. And then things began to go wrong. Sometimes I feel the future can be extremely dark.
We were speaking as the diplomatic offensive around Iraq collapsed into war, the sort of war that invariably, in Arab memory, rips open an 800-year-old wound of the Crusades.
There is a profound lack of understanding of the others. I'm not sure, for example, that my neighbor in this street knows more about Islam, for example, than his ancestor of the 12th century.
In Arab Islam, he picks out the people who have lost faith in the future and would just as soon destroy the world and themselves. In America, he sees people who would love to rule the world by force as if it was something that could be done forever.
I trust none of them. I belong to none of them. And I'm not even content with my status of observer. I'm just... Sometimes it looks like a bad dream.
In the last words of Leo the African, Malouf's invention in fiction tells his son to flee all groupings by skin or by prayers. In the final place, he says, no man is a stranger before the face of the Creator. Malouf today is more urgent about it. It's our tribal attachments, he says, that could bring us all down together. When we come back, novels that talk back to totalitarians. You're listening to The Whole Wide World, produced in association with WGBH Radio Boston from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World, at the link between literature and life. Azar Nafisi made her own breakthrough connection with a peculiar combination of a book and a setting. The book was Lolita. The setting was Iran in the heyday of the Mullah's Islamic Revolution. Azar Nafisi had gone home from the States to teach. Her key class was underground. It was a clandestine book club in her living room in Tehran. Every Thursday morning for 2 years, seven women arrived, removed their robes and veils, and talked about forbidden works of literature, like Lolita, and about their own lives as women in an Islamic republic.
When I went back home after the revolution in 79, I was absolutely shocked at the transformation that my country had gone through. And by, as I lived there, I discovered that the form of totalitarianism I had read about in books, which had happened in my country, what it does, it takes tries to take control not over your political life and social life, but also control of your mind, your feelings, and your emotions. And when you are deprived of the most precious aspects of your life, you constantly and instinctively try to move towards them. And books, and especially Lolita, became ways for me to take back the confiscated aspects of my life.
It sounds like an odd focus for Iranian women, that novel about a nymphette named Lolita.
They called Lolita immoral, but after the Islamists took over Iran, they changed all the laws related to women, and they lowered the age of marriage from 18 to 9. Plus the fact that, of course, they reintroduced polygamy and all sorts of good stuff like that. So for me, Lolita was confiscation of one individual's life by another. Humbert Humbert is living this illusion about his childhood love, Annabel Lee, who has died, 2 decades ago almost. And he, in Lolita, he tries to rediscover Annabel Lee, and he tries to stop Lolita's life and impose his own dream on Lolita, and he destroys her and ultimately himself. This is what totalitarian societies do to their people. They confiscate the reality of their life, and they want them to become the object of their dreams. Lolita became for us very relevant.
Azar Nafisi, you write in such fresh ways, things that we've intuitively known for a long time, that fiction is not just a refuge. Fiction of all kinds is a kind of truth, even in the worst storms, war, crisis, agony.
fiction is not only not just a refuge, but it's a wake-up call. I think great works of fiction become automatically subversive, not because they take political positions, because we can change our political positions with time, but because they basically question reality as it is. And I'll take the most politically conservative ones. Take Jane Austen. You know, the way that I see it, and my students in Tehran saw it, was that Jane Austen, at the center of her novel, is not the issue of marriage, but the issue of choice. And the fact that a young woman, Elizabeth Bennet, refuses against the dictates of her family, her society, the norms, and again, and the fact that she might starve to death if she doesn't marry into some form of money. She refuses to marry a man whom she does not love. And of course, the form of the novel is so democratic because there's so many voices there. Austen allows all these voices, even the villains, to talk, which goes against the grain of all totalitarian mindsets, so whether they are in America or they are in Iran or in Baghdad, you know, it doesn't matter. And Rushdie, of course, is another form of rebellion. I love the way he plays with words. How could anyone say that he's talking about a religion? He is in love with words and with fiction telling. And he's subversive because he questions our basic smug values, not because he's anti anything.
So for Azar Nafisi and her secret book group, novels and literature provided a window on their own experience, a perspective on history, and maybe a different way of seeing altogether.
I remember that Nabokov, in one of his novels, talks about how writers have the third eye of imagination, and the great Persian poet Rumi also talks about the other kind of the eye that opens towards the heart, that sees the unseen. And I think with novelists, they have the passion that scientists have for discovery of truth beyond what is real. So they go deep into things that are ordinary and normal with us, and they give it to us in a fresh way, you know. And novelists themselves die, and they might be conservative, they might be reactionary, they might be extreme radicals, but what remains is that third of eye of imagination. And the best example, maybe also not the best but one of the best examples, is Tolstoy's Haji Murad, which is about an actual conflict between the Russians and the Chechens in the mid 1800s, and Tolstoy himself was there, you know, as a young military man in the Caucasus. And Haji Murad was one of the Chechen chieftains who had problems with their leader Shamil, and he decided to defect to the Russians in order to fight against Shamil. But he's betrayed by both sides. He's betrayed both by Russians and the Chechens, and in the end, while he's trying to make his escape, he's killed. But Tolstoy talks about the fact that what he wanted to examine was not just the heroism of Haji Murad, but the absolute of the two leaders, both the Chechen leader and the Russian Tsar, and to show that how their eyes are closed not only to their enemies. Obviously, whenever we try to kill someone, we call them vermins, and you know, less than, you know, to justify the fact that we killed them, but also the absolutism on both sides. The fact is that what we should fear is not other civilizations, but absolutism, both at home and abroad. I mean, you know, at the center of novel or any form, art form, poetry, music, painting, film, is curiosity about the other. Even when we write about ourselves, we write in order to discover what we don't know about ourselves. And the absolutist minds go against this grain.
This matter of curiosity about the other and confrontation with the other seems to me very close to the heart of the problem today, in that,
yes.
You know, we've been through 40, 50 years of a kind of post-colonial getting acquainted with new people, new writers, new artists, new musicians, but the sort of the Salman Rushdie era, Michael Ondaatje, Rohinton Mystery, V.S. Naipaul, C.L.R. James is a favorite of mine, Derek Walcott, all those Nobel Prize winners from parts of the world that we simply didn't know before. I sometimes wonder if that period, and that sort of post-colonial discovery is now running headlong into a kind of neo-imperial reclassifying the other as a problem.
Well, you know, the great thing about culture is I think cultures have always gained when they opened up. Muslims in Middle Ages discovered Plato and Aristotle, and they translated them from Greece and introduced them through Spain to Europe. So, in fact, Europe owes its St. Augustine and Aquinas to the Islamic tradition. This is how cultures interact. And I think that those who lived in the former colonies, in India, in Africa, in the Middle East, by absorbing the forms that came to them from the West, like the novel, theater, music, painting, they recreated the novel. They reintroduced different forms to the novel. You mentioned the names of Naipaul or Salman Rushdie, and also we have the Latin Americans like Marquez and Leosa. And of course, we owe so much to the East European writers like Milos or Kundera, or one of my favorites, Gombrowicz, all of these people who reintroduced the concept of freedom to us. People over here sometimes become very smug. One reason they don't read Nabokov or Austen as much as they should comes out of what Saul Bellow calls the ordeal of or sufferings of freedom, that we forget that we have fought for these values. So people in those other countries remind us that these values are fragile and precious, you know, and they should be guarded.
What did these writers that you admire tell us about a kind of the shape of a global culture?
Well, you know, I remember, I think it was last year, and the well-known Latin American writer, I think he's now teaching at Georgetown, Vargas Llosa, wrote an article about globalization and about the fact that many people in other countries are scared of the American influence. But he was also talking about how this could be reversed. I mean, The great thing about the internet, if we use it correctly, is that we can genuinely create a dialogue of civilizations.
Yes.
In Iran right now, the former Iranian revolutionaries who constantly quoted Ayatollah Khomeini are now quoting Hannah Arendt and Karl Popper and Kant and Spinoza.
Iranians reading the Western classics could be our cue to discover the sensuality of the Syrian poet Naza Aboni or the Palestinian Mahmoud Darwish.
Now, when you go to the writings, to the work of these artists and writers, you discover that they negate all the claims that their politicians are making. When they say this is our culture, you know, our culture is stoning women to death, you know, beheading people. This is not the Islamic culture. Their culture is Rumi. Their culture is Hafez these other writers. So they teach the West a lot about what these cultures genuinely are about. And they teach the West something about itself. You know, one other thing people should read is 1001 Nights, Shahrazad. That shows people how sensual and imaginative and playful people of the East are. After all, Shahrazad has been influencing writers from time immemorial in the West.
In the sanctuary of her living room, that scene outside of scared, shrouded faces disappeared. A city and a book and readers were for the moment transformed.
The room for us became a haven, and I was always surprised by how many people showed up, you know, when there was the threat of the war. And one of my students one day in the room told me that when I come upstairs and, you know, I take my robe off, I feel as if that other reality that I have to go back to does not exist. I encourage them to try and articulate that through a poem or a writing, and that very much empowered them. Because, you know, one thing writing does, it empowers you, because a life that is not controllable, and in the Islamic Republic of Iran, life was not controllable. We had to dress from head to toe, we had to cover ourselves. There were militia patrols, Toyota patrols in the streets of Tehran at the time I was there, with two armed men and two armed women, just not looking for political opposition, looking for girls showing a bit of hair, wearing, you know, lipstick. And they would be flogged. Many of my students were flogged for wearing lipstick in the streets. In that room, by talking about this reality, we reshaped it. We recreated it. And I think Nabokov, who lost all his life, everything he had in the Russian Revolution, also did the same thing. That is how he recreated his life. He had no power in real life, but he had the power to talk about those son of a guns any way he wanted to when he wrote. And he took his revenge. And how many people remember Stalin now? And how many people remember Vladimir Nabokov or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky? That should be a warning to all politicians all over the world.
When events are in the saddle writing mankind, remember that it's artists and writers who will crystallize the meaning even of the days we're living through. When we come back, an Indian novelist on the backdrop of empire. You're listening to The Whole Wide World from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World. We're talking about novelists as prophets. The Iranian Azar Nafisi was just speaking about grand old dead ones like Tolstoy. Before her, Amin Maalouf was speaking as a living witness of tribalism, East and West. Amitav Ghosh is a rising star among the post-colonial writers in the Salman Rushdie constellation of novelists from the other side of the British Empire. Early on in the bombing, slogging war with Iraq, he was dismayed at how little Americans have absorbed about the perils of empire for everybody.
I felt a profound sense of despair. We have achieved so little in making, as it were, the world aware of the real dangers of empire, you know, of what is implicit in the whole business of launching upon an empire. And this became clear to me recently when I was having conversations with various people in America who, you know, displayed to me in conversations such a truly shocking ignorance of, you know, the very complex history of empire. It just made me realize that for them, they saw empire really, whichever side of empire they may be on, they saw it merely as the projection of force, which it isn't at all. You know, I mean, empire is essentially, you know, it's the circumstance of remaking, reinventing a reality that you meet. It's the fantasy of the creator in some sense, you know.
Amitav Ghosh has lots to tell you about empire. First, that it's always been about capturing minds as well as resources. Second, that the imperial enterprise typically leads its masters to excess and its opponents over the edge into horrific madness. Third, that this newborn consciousness of American empire could be the closing chapter in the history of several centuries. Fourth, that the old European masters of empire are happily out of the business. And fifth, from his perspective as an Indian who now lives, writes, and raises his American children in Manhattan, Americans look unprepared for the global mastery that we've stumbled into.
I think it really is a sort of turning point in history. Really, I mean, we've come to the culmination of one very, very long process. I think it's something that I would call, you know, the Anglophone Empire. And I've actually seen this process develop in America over the last 10 years, and it's been very, very disturbing to me, you know, because when I first arrived in America, you know, the first time I visited America was in 1988. And at that time, empire was really a bad word. America was still in the at a moment when the word empire really was redolent of Ronald Reagan's evil empire and so on. And, you know, after the Soviet Union fell, straight away, you know, my deepest misgivings were really about what it implied for the future of America.
Amitav Ghosh is a novelist, a child of post-colonial India. His father was a lieutenant colonel with the British Indian Army in the Bridge Over the River Kwai Burma campaign against the Japanese in World War II. Amitav was born in the India that Mahatma Gandhi had liberated from the Brits. But that English-speaking empire, he says, never died.
I'm talking about a project which has been in the making for 300 years, yeah. Imagine yourself to be a historian from Mars, you know, I mean, who arrives on the planet Earth and, you know, looks at the history of the planet Earth. How would you read its history? About 500 years ago, a small group of people from a small island began to expand outwards. Today, in effect, they control really three continents. And it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, this amazing sort of global diaspora. And there's no word for it. So, you know, if you look at this phenomenon, which is perfectly self-evident to people everywhere in the world, you know, that this group of Anglophone countries really has, in some sense, shouldered the responsibility for running the world. But it's not just shouldered the responsibility, it's also shouldered all the benefits. Not only that, if you look at, say, the global media, let's say just the global voice, it's almost overwhelmingly dominated by, Hollywood, you know, Australians, Americans, Canadians, British, figure in it almost completely to the exclusion of everybody else. So if you look at it from the world outside, you know, you can see in some sense that this is a project which has really reached, as it were, its complete culmination, which is absolute global dominance and absolute control of all resources, but not absolute control of the global mind.
Amitav Ghosh's masterpiece, titled The Glass Palace, is an epic of the British in Burma over the span of a century. It reads at moments like a parable of the U.S. in Iraq, but it was written before 9/11, and it's rooted in real history, starting in 1885, the shock and awe of British forces that captured Burma and its teak forests and its oil.
Burma's a very good example. You know, in 1885, when the British fought the Third Anglo-Burmese War, when they actually destroyed the Kingdom of Burma, it was preceded by exactly this narrative. The King Thibaw of Burma was set up as a tyrant, a bloodthirsty murderer who'd murdered hundreds of people. And in fact, he, you know, in some way, conclusions, you know, if you read history in a certain way, could be justified. So the idea was, so that was the first preceding narrative. Then the second one is that, you know, he's not only is he a tyrant, he's sitting on a whole heap of oil. Because remember, Burma was the first country to produce oil. You know, Burma Shell oil of today was actually Burma Shell, you know. So they wanted, you know, he was sitting on oil, he was sitting on teak, he was sitting on gems, he was sitting on a lot of minerals, which were very important for the time. So, you know, there was this dual narrative. One, that, you know, there's a tyrant and, you know, we have to liberate Burma. And the other, you know, there is also, you know, this whole world of mineral resources. So they go off, and it's very, they go off with this sort of display of shock and awe, a very powerful army, completely sort of outgunned the local people. The local people fought fierce little sort of battles of resistance, but they were completely overrun, you know. They used gunships in a way that they'd never been used before in the Asian continent. And, you know, within a matter of days, this place collapsed. What's very interesting is if you look at the English version of this, because, the English version is all we have, you know, Burmese hardly wrote about it. But for them, this is never called an invasion. It's always called a campaign of pacification, you know. But, you know, what is a campaign of pacification? I mean, after that, Burma became the great oil producer. One single sort of port in Burma used to export perhaps more than the rest of India put together, you know. But at the end of it, it's a completely broken place.
For all the oil in Burma then or in Iraq today, he observes that imperial conquest is never just about seizing resources. It's bigger than that. Empire is the business of reinventing the world in our image. It's the fantasy of the creator. It presents itself as a high-minded, improving project. The Spanish and Portuguese had a church blessing to convert the heathen. The British were certain that real freedom consisted of living under British rule. The storyline is always that we're here to help you. Problem is, the storyline is too good to be true, as illustrated in Gosha's novel, The Glass Palace.
You know, there's a section in this which has to do with a plantation owner, and it's a kind of metaphorical section, you know. He's running a perfect plantation, you know. Every rubber tree is meant to be alike. It's meant to be absolutely perfect. And one day, there's a scene there where one day he tells his friend that, you know, even within this perfection, you can always find a tree which decides to fight the pattern. And I think that's human nature. It's simply impossible. No matter how perfect a system America may embody or that Britain may embody, simply because it's a system that you want to make, as it were, the only system for the whole world, everybody in the world will resist it. Because it's outside the human condition to reconcile ourselves to, you know, the idea of such singularity. You know, human beings simply cannot live in a circumstance where there's only one way of life. It's impossible for us to imagine that. That would be, for human beings, the most absolute kind of tyranny. It doesn't matter whether that's a very enlightened way of life. It could be the most enlightened way of life. But simply because it's singular, it would arouse all the hostilities of the whole world. You see, one of the things that we see, you know, that results from empire is that empire, in this process of remolding, because an empire actually recreates the world within a certain image, if you like, or, you know, recasts it in the direction of in the form of another image, what happens thereafter is that all the ills of the world come to attach to that empire, whether it's responsible for it or not. So, I mean, for example, you know, if you travel around colonial countries, you know, countries that have once been colonized, you can see that, you know, what the British are held responsible for, you know, often, is not just the ills that, you know, that they're responsible for, but for every ill. And indeed, in a sense, they are responsible for every ill. So, you know, there's a very sort of complex relationship there. I mean, for the English as well, the whole idea was, you know, to set people free as they conceived it. Only this freedom, for the English always, freedom consisted of being under English rule. So you can imagine that for many people in the world, they didn't see it in the same way. And I was very struck, you know, when I was researching my book, The Glass Palace, I interviewed so many, you know, ex-Indian Army soldiers who'd actually fought in these colonial wars. You know, I mean, who'd fought for the British in the colonial wars. And, you know, many of them later became rebels against the British. You know, they joined movements against the British. And I'd ask them, you know, how did this happen that you suddenly, you know, you were fighting for the British and then suddenly one minute you turned against them? And you know what they all said? They said, you know, there came a time when we realized that for these people, what freedom meant is being under their rule, under their control. For them means freedom. That's what the word means to them. And that was when we realized that we didn't want to be a part of that particular project.
The crushing burden of empire on identity is personified in The Glass Palace in the soldier Arjun. He's an Indian fighting, as Gosha's father did, with the British Army in Southeast Asia. Late in the game, he realizes that he's been had. He's just brown-skinned cannon fodder in an imperial project, and he goes berserk. Gosha's point is that empire creates a conflict of loyalties, an impossible dilemma.
And there comes to him a moment when he's facing defeat at the hands of the Japanese in northern Malaysia. And he has, as it were, this sort of epiphany where he sees that, you know, where he asks himself, who am I and what am I doing? And he realizes that even though he's fighting for the British, he's always been marginalized within this army, that he and other Indians have been, as it were, the cannon fodder for this army. And at that moment, unlike, say, anti-colonial rebels of 1857, Arjun comes from a generation which actually has completely accepted the premises of the British universe. You know, he feels that, you know, what the British have offered is a kind of meritocracy. Suddenly, when he's in the army, he discovers that that's not quite the case. And that's when he reaches this really terrifying conclusion.
Here's his character Arjun speaking to his mate Hardy at a moment of truth.
Just look at us, Hardy. Just look at us. What are we? We've learned to dance the tango and we know how to eat roast beef with a knife and fork. The truth is that except for the color of our skin, most people in India wouldn't even recognize us as Indians. When we joined up, we didn't have India on our minds. We wanted to be sahibs, and that's what we've become. But the empire was dead now. He knew this because he had felt it die within himself, where it had held its strongest dominion. And with whom was he now to keep faith? Loyalty, commonality, faith. These things were as essential and as fragile as the muscles of the human heart. Easy to destroy, impossible to rebuild. How would one begin the work of recreating the tissue that bound people to each other? This was beyond the abilities of someone such as himself, someone trained to destroy. It was a labor that would last not 1 year, not 10, not 50. It was the work of centuries. Those of us who've seen the empire, you know, really from our end, it's the conclusion which really humbles you, that when you look at it, in the end, the empire has made everything you know. It's the only past you have. And it's to cross that Rubicon is a very difficult thing. And that's why, in some sense, you know, what's even more difficult than empire is the opposition to empire. Because one thing that we see about hegemony, which is for us, which is for me at least, the most frightening thing about hegemony, is that all opposition to hegemony ultimately becomes grotesque. It takes on grotesque forms.
The diabolical attack on civilians in the World Trade Center, or the grotesqueness of Palestinian suicide bombers, fit all too familiarly in Amitav Ghosh's history of empire.
You can see exactly the same process operating in the Middle East, really, where, you know, many, many Arabs, I'm sure, feel a great deal of sympathy for the forms of opposition that have been springing up. And yet, when they look at it, they say that, you know, this project is going to destroy us. We will be the first to be destroyed by this.
As in the Intifada or the attack on the World Trade Center.
Exactly. So, you know, in some really terrible way, you can see some sort of ghastly history playing itself out here, you know. One very good example, you know, is the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, which was again, you know, a sort of nationalist project in the end. But, you know, one of the strangest elements of the Khmer Rouge massacres is that they were not killing another ethnic group.
Exactly.
They were killing themselves.
Yes.
But it was done under the guise of killing the enemy within. And the enemy within was the group of people that had, as it were, incorporated aspects of colonialism. You know, so it was always the middle class. You know, his whole idea was to, he stopped the circulation of money, he destroyed the schools, he destroyed the books. But what was it really? Because he himself, Pol Pot, was educated in France, you know. And, you know, he was sent there. It was possible for him to go to France because he had an aunt who was a famous dancer. And she was a mistress of one of the members of the royal family. And she kept him in the palace, you know. And so he was brought up within the royal palace, you know. And then he went to France where he was radicalized. And then he came back from France. And, you know, one of the most appalling things about this whole thing is that eventually the Khmer, he got his own men to slice the breasts of his aunt. It becomes almost a physical metaphor of rooting out everything in yourself that you recognize to be in any way indebted to that past, to that compromised past. And that's what becomes, you know, this absolute grotesqueness. I think that certainly, the Bin Laden variety of fundamentalism is exactly a sort of replica of this. You know, you see here a man who's just completely internalized, Western forms of organization, Western forms of knowledge, and who's launched upon
airplanes and cell phones and
that's right.
Credit cards and
So many of those young, Arab militants in Afghanistan were wearing Dolce and Gabbana. I mean, it really makes you think. But the project that they're launched upon is completely, it's a project which in some sense can only succeed at the cost of destroying the people who embody it, you know. So, I mean, in some way, that's the sort of horror of it.
India, he says, was an exception. It was a colony that created a democracy in the face of empire.
And I think that's really Gandhi's greatness, you know, that we in India were rescued from this fate, you know, is really just a tribute to Gandhi, who recognized that, you know, if at this point we want to dig out of our hearts everything in it that's English, in the end we will only mutilate ourselves, you know. And I think that's his greatness, that he recognized that, you know, whether we like it or not, history has happened, and we have to make our peace with it.
Amitav Ghosh still doubts that Americans, on the whole, buy into their imperial role.
I think in America, things often flip over quite quickly, and I think we're beginning to see the beginnings of that. And you really wonder, in retrospect, one day people will wake up and say, who dreamt this dream, you know?
A dream or a nightmare? Of course we can't be sure yet. The news events don't often explain themselves. Life is short, art is long. The story in all of these stories is yet to be written. Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison of transom.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kaya Wilson, Justin Grotlucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden.
PRI, Public Radio International.